BSI in the World, I'm John Batchelor. Bloomberg headline, positive. World economy has growing chance of soft landing, G20 says. G20 are the 20 largest economies, the U.S. leads, of course, and the meeting of the finance ministers in Sao Paulo promises better days ahead, we believe. We note that the likelihood, said the draft, of a soft landing in the global economy has increased. Risks to the global economic outlook are more balanced. Upside risks include faster than expected disinflation. I welcome Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State, and before that, many years observing China in Hong Kong for the Wall Street Journal editorial page. Mary, I begin with prosperity, or the promise of such, because we know the best tool that the U.S. has and its allies against the axis of resistance is that our economies are beautiful, transparent, ambitious, and at the same time free. And that is a great recommendation. We've gone through a bad patch of the pandemic. We're in some stage of recovery that we can argue about percentages. But in any event, I start with the G20 finance ministers in Sao Paulo, because I think that's the best single advertisement to the part of the world that wants prosperity. Do you agree with me, Mary? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. Of course, we should all want robust, sustainable, healthy economic growth, because it's the key to human flourishing. And it's been the secret to the United States' post-World War II success, this incredibly competitive capitalist system that we enjoy, underpinned by a strong, predictable rule of law, property rights, and a free press, which allows an outside monitoring of boards of directors and CEOs and the like. It's also very easy in the United States to go bankrupt and to start over again. So lots of reasons why this news out of the G20 should be welcomed. But it is kind of ironic, John, that in celebrating the possibility of a soft landing, and we should say that we're not out of the woods just yet, inflation may prove to be stickier than most economists on Wall Street and in official government ministries anticipate. Remember that many economists were predicting 5 to 7 Federal Reserve interest rate cuts this year. Now that's down to 3, and it might soon be whittled to 1. But you know, it was the members of the G20 that, of course, created this problem of inflation through keeping interest rates too low for too long and creating too much money. And so, while yes, we should celebrate the prospect of a soft landing, we're not out of the woods yet, and there's no responsibility taken by the culprits who created this problem in the first place.
Let's move to the culprits, the axis of resistance. There are positive headlines in that direction as well, beginning steps, because what we look at in Ukraine is an ongoing conflict, not only in the battle zone, but between members of the EU, 27, and participants in NATO and the United States. Here's a positive headline from Bloomberg Europe. EU's new defense plan aims to boost European military purchases. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, says the subhead, left the bloc's industry struggling to ramp up capacity and spending. So a new plan, joined with the positive news that Sweden has now cleared the final hurdle. I believe Hungary's assembly approved Sweden joining NATO. So Finland and Sweden are now good parts of NATO, and there's a defense plan in EU. Now, there are headlines that match this that can be discouraging. For example, the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, said at a meeting he gathered in Paris of the leadership of the EU, he says, quote, the Financial Times headline, sending Western troops to Ukraine cannot be ruled out. Immediately, the Chancellor of Germany, Olaf Scholz, responded, Scholz rules out NATO troops to Ukraine. So there's tension within the organization, the prosperous EU, that looks to recover. Mary, we pay attention to the war because of our own politics, but they're the same politics in Europe. You've been in rooms with the European Union. Is this a body that we should regard as always in competition with itself? Does Paris bait Berlin and vice versa? How to regard these dueling remarks, given that they know that they've fallen behind on defense matters?
Well, look, the ugly truth is that the nations of Europe have not had to spend money on their own defense because of the U.S. defense umbrella and the enormous numbers of U.S. troops that are stationed in places like Germany as a remnant of the Cold War. You cannot talk of Europe as a unitary body, as you imply, because the nations of Eastern Central Europe and the Baltic states obviously are physically more threatened from the Russian onslaught in Ukraine than the nations of Western Europe simply by dint of their geography. You also have some perverse incentives that have been embedded in the system thanks to Italian, French, and German business with Russia, which is now being reordered thanks to the war. And in the meantime, in the United States, we don't feel that geographic proximity, nor do we feel the real economic impact because we're not as dependent on things like Russian energy. So there are a lot of cross currents at work here. Unfortunately, based on what I saw during my time in government, is that the Europeans will not take drastic steps to provide for their own defense unless the United States leads. And so this odd halfway house that you spoke of with the Germans, for instance, where, you know, they've become the second largest provider of military aid to Ukraine, but they won't send Kyiv things that they need to win the war, like Taurus missiles, which have a long range capability, which Ukraine desperately needs in order to hit behind enemy lines and get supply lines of the Russians and take them out. You know, France, Germany, and the UK, they've signed a bilateral security agreements with Ukraine. But if they don't build up their own domestic defense capabilities, they won't be able to supply anything to them. So we're caught in this odd place because Washington, too, is caught in the middle, where President Biden, as we've talked about ad nauseum, has said, you know, we back Ukraine, but we're just effectively not going to give them the weapons to win. And so you have needless lives lost. You have the increase of the chance of an accident that draws us in. You have time for Russia, China, Iran, North Korea to get together and strengthen the Russian side. It's a very, very perilous position. And the only thing that Putin respects is power. And we are not fully projecting our power or our intent. And that is putting the world in a very dangerous place.
To come to the United States, there is no clarity here, but I'll do what I can. The Congress has not taken up the request from the administration for additional monies for Ukraine, yes, for the Gaza war, Israel, yes, for the border, yes, and in general commitment to the Indo-Pacific has not taken up that request. The package has a lot in it. And I'm reminded of the term that's often been used about the Republican Party in the 20th century, now in the 21st, isolationism. I'm also struck by the irony. Recently, speaking with Nick Bunker, the author of a new book about the period Labor Day 49 to the attack by North Korea in June of 1950, that 10-month period, that the Bob Taft's Republican Party, not Donald Trump's Republican Party, not George Bush's Republican Party, but Bob Taft's Republican Party, Mr. Conservative of Ohio, was isolationist, anti-Marshall Plan, anti-NATO, which at that point wasn't armed at all. It was just a treaty with broken manufacturing base in Europe that had to be rebuilt with the Marshall Plan. So 85 years later, Mary, it's the same Republican Party going through the same arguments. How do you measure right now the Republican reluctance to support the Ukrainian war?
Well, I think politically the reluctance is understandable. Republicans have often focused on the budget and spending historically, and they haven't seen a plan to win from the Biden White House. Of course, this ignores that the biggest problem in U.S. government spending is not defense, but entitlements, and nobody wants to touch that. So it's a bit of a duplicitous argument. That being said, just like Europe, you can't talk about the Republican Party as a unified whole. There are many factions in it. I've just described what could be termed the MAGA faction and their understandable concern about how the money's being spent. There's a more traditional Reaganite faction, several of whom have gotten together with Democrats just in these last days and rolled out just another attempt to provide aid to give Democrats some of what they want, but to give various factions of the Republican Party what they want, too. I think that's encouraging. And then you have a very small minority who are full-blown isolationists who see political gain in advocating that position, some of which they genuinely believe it to be true. I don't agree with that. I actually don't think that President Trump was an isolationist. We worked very, very hard to get our NATO allies to increase their defense spending, which they did. We worked hard to unleash U.S. energy, which punished Putin. We sanctioned his inner circle. We gathered nations of the world together to take action and enact consequences when he did things like use chemical weapons on British soil and in Syria. We had unanimous NATO support to withdraw from the INF treaty, which was a missile defense treaty we had inked with Russia many years in the past, which Russia always broke. But none of that ever gets talked about, right, when you read the headlines or you listen to descriptions. But the Trump foreign policy toward Putin and Russia, we advocated against Nord Stream 2. We pressured Germany very hard on that, was not a policy of isolationism. It was a policy of strength and deterrence, and it worked. And so it's a perilous period because it's a political transitional year here in the United States. It's perilous because the Biden administration has not laid out a plan to win. And it's perilous because we don't have leadership among our European allies, which we never do. And we shouldn't really expect. It's unfortunate, but it's just how it is. And so I think these next few months will be critical. And I think this bipartisan attempt in the House to push forward aid for Ukraine while they work to build their own defense, domestic military industrial base, that's the thing to watch in the coming days and weeks.
I said 85 years because I was dating this from Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan. And the irony here is that Arthur Vandenberg, the senator, was outspokenly isolationist in the period 1938 to 1941 and the attack by the Japanese and the declaration of war by the Hitlerites. Openly isolationist, avowedly so. And then he reversed himself. And in 1949, 1950, he opposed the isolationism of the Republican Party. He fought against it as hard as he could. He died of lung cancer, tragically, within a few months of the beginning of the Korean War. So I tell this anecdote because there's always hope in the Republican Party that common sense will prevail. It did for Arthur Vandenberg, and it did for Barry Goldwater, and it can for whoever is leading the Republican isolationism today. It changes from week to week. We're going to turn to the People's Republic of China and the threat in the Indo-Pacific when we come back. Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State, and in China with the Hong Kong for the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.